Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, November 28th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is a warm 46 degrees and partly sunny here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Uncanny Valley, Avatars, Robots, AI Warnings, Hillary, and Plasmonics. We took a look at a lot of different warnings about AI yesterday. One was from Mark Cuban, which I thought was kind of odd. A couple new ones from Elon Musk. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton coming out warning us about the coming artificial intelligence and how dangerous that is going to be to our future. Well, today we're going to continue that vein of thought. We're going to be listening to a TED Talk recorded October 19th, 2016 with Dr. Sam Harris. He is a neuroscientist and a philosopher. And he asks, should we be scared of super intelligent AI? He says, you should be. And not just in some theoretical way, because he says that we are going to build superhuman machines. And we have to worry about whether or not they are going to treat us the way we treat ants, with complete disregard when we get in the way of their plans. So why don't you check this out? This is a pretty interesting TED Talk. Sam Harris is a pretty interesting guy. And think about where this is going to take us to tomorrow. He seems to think that the only way around this not-too-distant future is to have some global calamity. Otherwise, it's going to happen regardless. So here, enjoy the talk.
I'm going to talk about a failure of intuition that many of us suffer from. It's really a failure to detect a certain kind of danger. I'm going to describe a scenario that I think is both terrifying and likely to occur. And that's not a good combination, as it turns out. And yet, rather than be scared, most of you will feel that what I'm talking about is kind of cool. I'm going to describe how the gains we make in artificial intelligence could ultimately destroy us. And in fact, I think it's very difficult to see how they won't destroy us or inspire us to destroy ourselves. And yet, if you're anything like me, you'll find that it's fun to think about these things. And that response is part of the problem. Okay, that response should worry you. If I were to convince you in this talk that we were likely to suffer a global famine, either because of climate change or some other catastrophe, and that your grandchildren or their grandchildren are very likely to live like this, you wouldn't think, interesting, I like this TED Talk. Okay. Famine isn't fun. Death by science fiction, on the other hand, is fun. And one of the things that worries me most about the development of AI at this point is that we seem unable to marshal an appropriate emotional response to the dangers that lie ahead. Okay, I'm unable to marshal this response, and I'm giving this talk. It's as though we stand before two doors. Behind door number one, we stop making progress in building intelligent machines. Our computer hardware and software just stops getting better for some reason. Now take a moment to consider why this might happen. I mean, given how valuable intelligence and automation are, we will continue to improve our technology if we are at all able to. What could stop us from doing this? A full-scale nuclear war? A global pandemic? An asteroid impact? Justin Bieber becoming president of the United States? The point is, something would have to destroy civilization as we know it. You have to imagine how bad it would have to be to prevent us from making improvements in our technology permanently, generation after generation. Almost by definition, this is the worst thing that's ever happened in human history. So the only alternative, and this is what lies behind door number two, is that we continue to improve our intelligent machines year after year after year. At a certain point, we will build machines that are smarter than we are. And once we have machines that are smarter than we are, they will begin to improve themselves. And then we risk what the mathematician I.J. Good called an intelligence explosion, that the process could get away from us. Now, this is often caricatured, as I have here, as a fear that armies of malicious robots will attack us. But that isn't the most likely scenario. It's not that our machines will become spontaneously malevolent. The concern is really that we will build machines that are so much more competent than we are that the slightest divergence between their goals and our own could destroy us. Just think about how we relate to ants. Okay, we don't hate them. We don't go out of our way to harm them. In fact, sometimes we take pains not to harm them. We step over them on the sidewalk. But whenever their presence seriously conflicts with one of our goals, let's say when constructing a building like this one, we annihilate them without a qualm. The concern is that we will one day build machines that, whether they're conscious or not, could treat us with similar disregard. Now, I suspect this seems far-fetched to many of you. I bet there are those of you who doubt that superintelligent AI is possible, much less inevitable. Right, but then you must find something wrong with one of the following assumptions, and there are only three of them. Intelligence is a matter of information processing in physical systems. Actually, this is a little bit more than an assumption. But we have already built narrow intelligence into our machines, and many of these machines perform at a level of superhuman intelligence already. And we know that mere matter can give rise to what is called general intelligence, an ability to think flexibly across multiple domains, because our brains have managed it, right? I mean, there's just atoms in here. As long as we continue to build systems of atoms that display more and more intelligent behavior, we will eventually, unless we are interrupted, we will eventually build general intelligence into our machines. It's crucial to realize that the rate of progress doesn't matter. Any progress is enough to get us into the end zone. We don't need Moore's law to continue. We don't need exponential progress. We just need to keep going. The second assumption is that we will keep going. We will continue to improve our intelligent machines. And given the value of intelligence, intelligence is either the source of everything we value or we need it to safeguard everything we value. It is our most valuable resource. So we want to do this. I mean, we have problems that we desperately need to solve. We want to cure diseases like Alzheimer's and cancer. We want to understand economic systems. We want to improve our climate science. So we will do this if we can. The train is already out of the station, and there's no brake to pull. Finally, we don't stand on a peak of intelligence, or anywhere near it, likely. And this really is the crucial insight. This is what makes our situation so precarious. And this is what makes our intuitions about risk so unreliable. Now just consider the smartest person who has ever lived. And almost everyone's short list here is John von Neumann. I mean, the impression that von Neumann made on the people around him, and this included the greatest mathematicians and physicists of his time, is fairly well documented. I mean, if only half the stories about him are half true, there's no question he's one of the smartest people who's ever lived. So consider the spectrum of intelligence. Here we have John von Neumann, and then we have you and me. And then we have a chicken. Sorry, a chicken. There's no reason for me to make this talk more depressing than it needs to be. It seems overwhelmingly likely, however, that the spectrum of intelligence extends much further than we currently conceive. And if we build machines that are more intelligent than we are, they will very likely explore the spectrum in ways that we can't imagine and exceed us in ways that we can't imagine. And it's important to recognize that this is true by virtue of speed alone, right? So imagine we just built a super intelligent AI, right, that was no smarter than your average team of researchers at Stanford or MIT. Well, electronic circuits function about a million times faster than biochemical ones. Okay, so this machine should think about a million times faster than the minds that built it. So you set it running for a week, and it will perform 20,000 years of human-level intellectual work, week after week after week. How could we even understand, much less constrain, a mind making this sort of progress? The other thing that's worrying, frankly, is that imagine Imagine the best case scenario. So imagine we hit upon a design of superintelligent AI that has no safety concerns. We have the perfect design the first time around. It's as though we've been handed an oracle that behaves exactly as intended. Well, this machine would be the perfect labor-saving device. It can design the machine, that can build the machine, that can do any physical work, powered by sunlight, more or less for the cost of raw materials. Okay, so we're talking about the end of human drudgery. We're also talking about the end of most intellectual work. So what would apes like ourselves do in this circumstance? Well, we'd be free to play Frisbee and give each other massages, you know, add some LSD and some questionable wardrobe choices, and the whole world could be like Burning Man. You know? Now, that might sound pretty good, but ask yourself, what would happen under our current economic and political order? It seems likely that we would witness a level of wealth inequality and unemployment that we have never seen before, absent a willingness to immediately put this new wealth to the service of all humanity. Okay, well, a few trillionaires could grace the covers of our business magazines while the rest of the world would be free to starve. And what would the Russians or the Chinese do if they heard that some company in Silicon Valley was about to deploy a superintelligent AI? This machine would be capable of waging war, right, whether terrestrial or cyber, with unprecedented power. Now, this is a winner-take-all scenario. To be 6 months ahead of the competition here is to be 500,000 years ahead, at a minimum. Okay, so it seems that even mere rumors of this kind of breakthrough could cause our species to go berserk. Now, one of the most frightening things, in my view, at this moment, are the kinds of things that AI researchers say when they want to be reassuring. And the most common reason we're told not to worry is time. This is all a long way off, don't you know? This is probably 50 or 100 years away. One researcher has said, worrying about AI safety is like worrying about overpopulation on Mars. Okay, this is the Silicon Valley version of, don't worry your pretty little head about it. Okay, that no one seems to notice that referencing the time horizon is a total non sequitur. If intelligence is just a matter of information processing, and we continue to improve our machines, we will produce some form of superintelligence. And we have no idea how long it will take us to create the conditions to do that safely. Let me say that again. We have no idea how long it will take us to create the conditions to do that safely. And if you haven't noticed, 50 years is not what it used to be. And this is 50 years in months. This is how long we've had the iPhone. This is how long The Simpsons has been on television. 50 years is not that much time to meet one of the greatest challenges our species will ever face. And once again, we seem to be failing to have an appropriate emotional response to what we have every reason to believe is coming. The computer scientist Stuart Russell has a nice analogy here. He said, imagine that we received a message from an alien civilization, which read, people of Earth, we will arrive on your planet in 50 years. Get ready. And now we're just counting down the months until the mothership lands? Okay. We would feel a little more urgency than we do. Another reason we're told not to worry is that these machines can't help but share our values because they will be literally extensions of ourselves. They'll be grafted onto our brains and will essentially become their limbic systems. Now take a moment to consider that the safest and only prudent path forward recommended is to implant this technology directly into our brains. Now this may in fact be the safest and only prudent path forward, but usually one's safety concerns about a technology have to be pretty much worked out before you stick it inside your head. Okay. The deeper problem is that building superintelligent AI on its own seems likely to be easier than building superintelligent AI and having a completed neuroscience that allows us to seamlessly integrate our minds with it. And given that the companies and governments doing this work are likely to perceive themselves to be in a race against all others, given that to win this race is to win the world, provided you don't destroy it in the next moment, then it seems likely that whatever is easier to do will get done first. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a solution to this problem. apart from recommending that more of us think about it. I think we need something like a Manhattan Project on the topic of artificial intelligence. Not to build it, because I think we'll inevitably do that, but to understand how to avoid an arms race and to build it in a way that is aligned with our interests. When you're talking about super intelligent AI that can make changes to itself, it seems that we only have one chance to get the initial conditions right. And even then, we will need to absorb the economic and political consequences of getting them right. But the moment we admit that information processing is the source of intelligence, that some appropriate computational system is what the basis of intelligence is, and we admit that we will improve these systems continuously, and we admit that the horizon of cognition very likely far exceeds what we currently know, then we have to admit that we're in the process of building some sort of God. Now would be a good time to make sure it's a God we can live with. Thank you very much.
And so now your main interest with robots is in how our relating to them could well and may, in fact, inevitably change the way we relate to other human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally fascinated by the way that we treat robots like they're alive, even though we know that they're not, and the implications that that might have for our behavior.
I must say, I'm kind of late to acquire this interest. Obviously, I've seen robots in science fiction for as long as I've seen science fiction, but it wasn't until watching Westworld, literally a couple of months ago, that I realized that the coming changes in our society based on whatever robots we develop are going to be far more interesting and ethically pressing than I realized. And this has actually nothing to do with what I thought was the central question, which is, will these robots be conscious? That is obviously a hugely important question, and a lot turns ethically on whether we build robot slaves that are conscious and can suffer. But even short of that, we have some really interesting things that will happen once we build robots that escape the what's now called the uncanny valley. This, I'll probably have you talk about what the uncanny valley is. And I think even based on some of your work, you know, you don't even have to get all the way out of the uncanny valley or even into it for there to be some ethical issues around how we treat robots, which we have no reason to believe are conscious. In fact, you know, we have every reason to believe that they're not conscious. So perhaps before we get to the edgy considerations of Westworld, maybe you can say a little bit about the fact that your work shows that people have their ethics pushed around even by relating to robots that are just these bubbly cartoon characters that nobody thinks are alive or conscious in any sense.
Yeah. We are so good at anthropomorphizing things, and it's not restricted to robots. I mean, we've always had kind of a tendency to name our cars and, you know, become emotionally attached to our stuffed animals and kind of imagine that they're these social beings rather than just objects. But robots are super interesting because they combine physicality and movement in a way that we will automatically project intent onto. So I think that it's so interesting to see people treat even the simplest robots like they're alive and like they have agency, even if it's totally clear to them that it's just a machine that they're looking at. So, you know, long before you get to any sort of complex humanoid Westworld type robot, people are naming their Roombas. People feel bad for the Roomba when it gets stuck somewhere just because it's kind of moving around on its own in a way that we project onto. And I think it goes further than just being primed by science fiction and pop culture to want to personify robots. Like, obviously, you know, we've all seen a lot of sci-fi and Star Wars, and, you know, we probably have this inclination to name robots and personify them because of that. But I think that there's also this biological piece to it that's even more that's even deeper and really fascinating to me. So one of the things that we've noticed is that people will have empathy for robots, or at least some of our work indicates that people will empathize with robots and be really uncomfortable when they're asked to destroy a robot or do something, you know, mean to it, which is fascinating.
Does this pose any ethical concern? Because obviously it's kind of an artificial situation to hand people a robot that is cute and then tell them to mistreat it. But there are robots being used in, I think, isn't it like a baby seal robot that you're giving people with Alzheimer's or autism? Is contact with these surrogates for affection, does that pose any ethical concerns, or is that just if it works on any level, it's intrinsically good in your view?
I think it depends. I think there is something unethical about it, but probably not in the way that most people intuitively think. So I think, you know, intuitively, it's a little bit creepy when you first hear that, oh, we're using these baby seal robots with dementia patients, and we're giving them the sense of nurturing this thing that isn't alive. That seems a little bit wrong to people at first blush. But I honestly, so if you look at what these robots are intended to replace, which is animal therapy, it's interesting to see that they can have a similar effect, and no one complains about animal therapy for, you know, dementia patients.
Right.
It's something that we often can't use because of hygienic or safety or other reasons, but we can use robots because people will consistently treat them sort of like animals and not like devices. And I also think that, you know, for the ethics there, it's important to look at some of the alternatives that we're using. So with the baby seal, if we can use that as an alternative to medication for calming distressed people, I'm really not so sure that that's really an unethical use of robots. I actually think it's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
So one of the things that does concern me, though, is that this is such an engaging and, or in other words, manipulative technology that, and we're seeing a lot of these robots being developed for kind of vulnerable parts of the population, like the elderly or children. A lot of kids' toys have increasing amounts of this kind of manipulative robotics in them. So I do wonder whether, you know, the companies that are making the robots might be able to use that in ways that aren't necessarily in the public interest, like get people to buy products and services or manipulate people into revealing more personal data than they would otherwise want to enter into a database. Things like that concern me. But those are more people doing things to other people rather than, you know, something intrinsically wrong about treating robots like they're alive.
So has there been anything like that? Have any companies with toy robots or elder care robots done anything that seems to push the bounds of propriety there in terms of introducing messaging that you wouldn't want in that kind of situation?
Yeah, I don't know any examples of like people trying to manipulate the elderly as of now. But I mean, we do have examples from, you know, the porn industry and having very manipulative chat bots that try and get you to sign up for services. So, and this was happening decades ago, right? So we do have a history of companies trying to use technology in advertising or say, you know, the in-app purchases that we see on iPads, where there have been consumer protection cases where, you know, kids were buying a bunch of things and now, you know, companies have had to implement all of these safeties so that it requires, you know, parental override in order to purchase stuff. Like, there's a history of, you know, we know that companies, you know, serve their own interests. And any technology that we develop that is engaging in the way that robots already are in their very primitive forms and will increasingly be, I think, might pose a consumer protection risk. Or you could even, you know, think of governments using robots that are increasingly entering into our homes and very intimate areas of our lives, governments using robots to, you know, collect more data about people and essentially spy on them.
So there's this basic fact where any system that seems to behave autonomously doesn't have to be humanoid, doesn't even have to have a lifelike shape. It doesn't have to draw on biology at all. As you said, it could be something like a Roomba. If it's sufficiently autonomous, it begins to kindle our sense that we are in relationship to another, which we can find cute or menacing or whatever we feel about it. It pushes our intuitions in the direction of this thing is a being in its own right. I believe you have a story about how a landmine diffusing robot that was insectile, like spider-like, could no longer be used, or at least one person in the military overseeing this project felt you could no longer use it because it was getting its legs blown off, and this was thought to be disturbing, even though, again, we're talking about a robot that isn't even close to being the sort of thing that you would think people would attribute consciousness to.
Yeah. And then, of course, with design, you can really start influencing that, right? So whether people think it's cute or menacing, or whether people treat it as a social actor, because there's this whole spectrum of, you know, you have a simple robot like the Roomba, and then you have a social robot that's specifically designed to mimic all of these cues that you subconsciously associate with states of mind. So we're seeing increasingly robots being developed that specifically try and get you to treat it like a living thing, like the baby seal.
Are there more robots in our society than most of us realize? What is here now, and what do you know about that's immediately on the horizon?
Well, I think what's sort of happening right now is we've had robots for a long time, but robots have been mostly kind of in factories and manufacturing lines and assembly lines and kind of behind the scenes. And now we're gradually seeing robots creep into all of these new areas. So the military or hospitals, we have these surgical robots, or transportation systems, autonomous vehicles. And we have these new household assistants. A lot of people now have Alexa or Google Home or other systems in their homes. And so I think we're just seeing an increase of robots coming into areas of our lives where we're actually going to be interacting with them in all sorts of different fields and areas.
So what's the boundary between, or is there a boundary between these different classes of robots?
Yeah, I don't think there's any, you know, clear line to distinguish these robots, also in terms of, you know, the effect that they have on people. You know, you see, depending on how a factory robot is designed, people will, you know, become emotionally attached to that as well. That's happened. And we also, I mean, by the way, we don't even have a universal definition of what a robot is.
Some of the robots I picture, like the robots I was picturing on an assembly line, are either fixed in place, and we're just talking about arms that are constantly moving and picking things up, or they're kind of moving on tracks, but they're not roving around in 360 degrees of freedom. I trust there are other robots that do that in industry as well.
Yeah. But like, so one question is, you know, is the inside of a dishwasher, is that a robot? Like, is that movement autonomous enough? It's basically what the factory robots are doing, but we call those robots. We don't call the dishwasher robot.
There's just this continuum of machines with greater and greater independence from human control and greater complexity of their routines, and there's no clear stopping point. Let's come back to this concept of the uncanny valley, which I've spoken about on the podcast before. What is the uncanny valley, and what are the prospects that we will get out of it anytime soon?
Yeah, the uncanny valley is a, you know, somewhat controversial concept that you can design something that is lifelike, but if as soon as you get too close to, I think for the uncanny valley, it's specifically humanoid. If you get too close to something that looks like a human, but you don't quite match what it is, then it suddenly becomes really creepy. So people will like the thing the more lifelike that it gets. And then once it gets too close, like the likability of it drops. Mm-hmm. It's like zombies or something that's human, but not quite human, really creeps us out. And then it doesn't go back up again until you can perfectly, like absolutely perfectly, mimic a human. And I think I like to think about it more, less in terms of the uncanny valley, more in terms of expectation management, I guess. So I think that if we see something that looks human, we expect it to act like a human. And if it's not quite up to that standard, I think it disappoints what we were expecting from it, and that's why we don't like it. And that's a principle that I see in robot design a lot. So a lot of the really, I think, compelling social robots that we develop nowadays are not designed to look like something that you're intimately familiar with. Like, I have this robot cat at home that Hasbro makes, and it's the creepiest thing. Because it's clearly not a real cat, even though it tries to look like one. Hmm. And it's very unlovable in a way. But I also have this baby dinosaur robot that is much more compelling because I've never actually interacted with a two-week-old Camarasaurus before. So it's much easier to suspend my disbelief and actually imagine that this is how a dinosaur would behave.
Right.
So it's interesting to see how, you know, the whole Westworld concept, you know, before we could even get there, we would really need to have robots that are so similar to humans that we wouldn't really be able to tell the difference.
What is the state of the art in terms of humanoid robots at this point? I mean, I've never actually been in the presence of any advanced robot technology that's attempting to be humanoid.
There are some Japanese androids that are pretty interesting. I don't think that, like, to me, they're not out of the uncanny valley yet, but there's also some conversation about whether the uncanny valley is cultural or not, and also I think some research on that, which I don't think is very conclusive, but it might be that in some cultures, you know, like in Japanese culture, people are more accepting of robots that look like humans but aren't quite there, because you know, people say that there's this religious background to it, the Shinto religion, the belief that objects can have souls, makes people more accepting of robotic technology in general, whereas in Western society, we're more creeped out by this idea that a thing, a machine, could, you know, resemble a living thing in a way. But I'm not really sure. And I mean, you should check out the androids that Ishiguro in Japan is making, because they're pretty cool. He made one that looks like himself, which is interesting to think about, you know, his own motivations and psychology behind that. But it is a pretty cool robot. I think, you know, just from a photograph, you might not be able to tell the difference. Probably in interacting with it, you would.
So do you think we will get to a Westworld level lifelikeness long before we get to the AI necessary to power those kinds of robots? Or, I mean, do you have any intuitions about how long it will take to climb out of the uncanny valley?
That's a good question. I honestly, I'm not as interested in, you know, how do we completely replicate humans, because I see so many interesting design things happening now where that's not necessary. Like, we can already with, and robotic technology is very primitive at this point. I mean, robots can barely operate a fork, but we can create characters that people will treat as though they're alive. And while it's not quite Westworld level, if we move away from this idea that we have to create humanoid robots and we create, you know, a blob, or, you know, some, we have a century of animation expertise to draw on in creating these compelling characters that people can relate to and that move in a really expressive way. And I think that that's, you know, much more interesting. I think much sooner than Westworld, we can get to a place where we are creating robots that people will consistently treat like living things, even if we know that they're machines.
I guess my fixation on Westworld is born of the intuition that something fundamentally different happens once we can no longer tell the difference between a robot and a person. And maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe this change and all of its ethical implications comes sooner when, as you say, we have a blob that people just find compelling enough to treat it as though it were alive. It just seems to me that Westworld is predicated on the expectation that people will want to use robots in ways that would truly be unethical if these robots were sentient. But because, on assumption or in fact, they will not be sentient, this becomes a domain of creative play analogous to what happens in video games. If you're using a first-person shooter video game, you are not being unethical shooting the bad guys. And the more realistic the game becomes, the more fun it is to play. And there's this sense that, I mean, while some people have worried about the implications of playing violent video games, all the data that I'm aware of suggests they're really not bad for us, and crime has only gone down in the meantime. And it seems to me that there's no reason to worry that as that becomes more and more realistic, even with virtual reality, it's going to derange us ethically. But watching Westworld made me feel that robots are different. Having something in physical space that is human-like to the point where it is indistinguishable from a human, even though you know it's not, it seems to me that will begin to compromise our ethics if we mistreat these artifacts. We'll not only feel differently about ourselves and about other people who mistreat them, we will be right to feel differently because we will actually be changing ourselves. You'd have to be more callous than in fact most people are to rape or torture a robot that is, in fact, indistinguishable from a person because all of your intuitions of being in the presence of personhood, of being in relationship, will be played upon by that robot, even though you know that it's been manufactured and, let's say, you've been assured it can't possibly be conscious. So the takeaway message from watching Westworld for me is that Westworld is essentially impossible, and we would just be creating a theme park for psychopaths and rendering ourselves more and more sociopathic if we tried to normalize that behavior. And I think what you're suggesting is that long before we ever get to something like Westworld, we will have, and may even have now, robots that, if you were to mistreat them callously, you would in fact be callous, and you'd have to be callous in order to do that, and you're not going to feel good about doing it if you're a normal person, and people won't feel good watching you do it if they're normal. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, we already have some indication that people's empathy does correlate with how they're willing to treat a robot, which is super interesting. And I like, Westworld is just the perfect illustration of the problem. I love that it's, I love that you watched Westworld, and even though you believe that, you know, if playing violent video games makes crime rates, you know, continue to go down, I don't know if you meant that in a causal way or not, but.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't. I just, presumably, if it was causing people to be more violent, we would not see crime rates go down in the meantime.
Yeah, I think so. I agree that the violence in video games research is completely inconclusive, and there's no reason to believe that we can't mentally compartmentalize in that case. But we do know that we respond very differently to physical things than something on a screen. We have this more visceral response to the physicality of robots, and there's some research to suggest that we do treat physical robots more like a social actor. So, like, you increasingly get into this question of how much more muddled it gets in your subconscious to mistreat a robot versus, you know, a first-person shooter game. And this is the question that I'm probably most interested in, right? What we don't know is whether, if take Westworld, whether if you go and play around in Westworld, whether that is just an indication of how callous you are, or whether it could actually desensitize you to that behavior towards real humans, or whether it's a really healthy outlet. If you have violent tendencies, you can go and you can beat the crap out of this really lifelike robot, and you know that you're not hurting a real person, and maybe that makes you a much better person in real life. You've gotten all of your aggressions out. And we just have no idea what direction this goes in. And the reason I think it's important to talk about long before we have any sort of Westworld, like, you know, theme park, is because we already see, you know, we see these children's toys that behave in a really lifelike way. I have this baby dinosaur at home that will cry if you mistreat it, and really mimic in a very convincing way that it's in pain. And you have to wonder, you know, whether there's reasons to prevent your kids from beating up the robot, the reasons that go beyond just, you know, obviously you want to teach your kids to not destroy things that are expensive. And we don't know, and it gets particularly, so one of the things that I think we could see in the near future and have literally no idea what to do with is child-sized sex robots. What do we do with that?
That's an arresting phrase that isn't often spoken on this podcast or any other. Child-sized sex robots. So this would be as a therapy for pedophiles, or just how do you envision this market even emerging?
Well, I mean, we already have. There was, I think in 2013, Canadian authorities seized a child-sized sex doll at the border that a Canadian had ordered from Japan. And so, you know, once we have robots on the market that people can buy, the question is, should those be legal or not? And if you look at, there's some analogy here to virtual child pornography, which is, you know, pornography made completely virtually with no real children involved. And countries have come down on very different sides of whether this should be legal or not. In the United States, it's legal. The Supreme Court has said First Amendment, you know, there's no actual harm here that has to be legal. Other countries have said no fucking way. Like, we can't allow this. It's disgusting. And I think nobody has any idea whether allowing it would actually help protect real children because it would provide an outlet for people, or whether it would encourage and normalize and propagate the behavior. And once you have robots, which again, bring this to a new level because of this visceral physicality that they have, and we will have this, right? I mean, I see no reason why this wouldn't happen in the next decade, and we don't know what to do with it. So that's why I think research in these areas, or just generally in the areas of how these lifelike robots can shift and change our behaviors in positive and negative ways, is so important right now.
It's a fascinating question. I think now I'm about to express an opinion on virtual child pornography. This is a topic I have not thought much about, but I'm going to recklessly say that I think this is pretty clear what the right stance is here, and it is what you just described as being the U.S. one. The obvious problem with child pornography is that a child was harmed in the creation of it and is harmed by the thing being out in the world thereafter. But this just is like a classic slippery slope situation. If you are going to outlaw virtual, which is to say completely fictional, child pornography, then you have to outlaw somebody drawing something that is sufficiently lifelike. Where does that sort of thing stop if artwork can become the equivalent of having actually victimized a child and recorded it on film? I just don't see what the stopping point is if you're going to debate that question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to agree with you. But then when you bring robots into it, so coming back to Westworld, if the question is, does it make people more callous or make them kind of used to a certain behavior if they go in and, you know, they rape these female robots, if that makes them more likely to go out and then, you know, get a taste for raping real women, you know, obviously that's not good. And that's also something that we could imagine happening, although we have no evidence for it. So. And I realize that this is a slightly bad comparison because we know so little about the psychology of pedophilia. But is it possible that using a robot could whet people's appetites or get them used to it or get them wanting more? We don't know.
You could imagine it going both ways, and then you would just have to sort of count the bodies to see where the balance should swing if you're just worried about the numbers of people who get victimized as a result.
I mean, so what else are you worried about?
I just don't know what that does to the human mind and human ethical norms, you know, over the course of decades and beyond. But it's not clear to me that the only negative consequences can be scored in terms of the numbers of people who get raped as a result.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
It just seems like a giant roll of the dice psychologically.
Yeah, I feel like sexuality is still such a mystery to us generally, and very under-researched. So it's really not clear to me also how fluid or flexible our sexual preferences are. So if you give people more options, will that just reflect their underlying preferences, or will it actually change over time, you know, the sexual relationships or preferences that we have? And I'm not sure we know the answer to that.
You could imagine it getting really weird, I mean, or weirder than we've just described, because obviously something like bestiality is, I gotta think, the fringe of the fringe of the fringe sexually, and such a
have you been on the internet, Sam?
I haven't been in that quadrant that would alert me to the fact that my neighbors are having sex with their pets, but people are going to be raping aliens or being raped by them.
So just yesterday I was looking up laws on bestiality, for a similar reason, which was I was curious whether, you know, sex robots shaped like animals, whether that would be legal to sell or not. And it turns out that...
You're now on some list, I'm convinced.
Oh, I'm sure I was already. Like, I already have some FBI file, I'm sure. But yeah, it is interesting Googling for that type of stuff. But it turns out that bestiality is legal in a lot of countries, but distributing pornography of it is not, which surprised me. I had no idea.
Yeah, I would say that's a stark sign of confusion, but...
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, we already do have some weird sex toys out there. Like, there are Twilight dildos that you can put in the freezer so that you can pretend to be having sex with a vampire. Or I think Fleshlight, you know, the Fleshlight thing, which is this sex toy, like vagina, it looks like a big flashlight.
The first time I went on Joe Rogan's podcast, when he was not nearly as big a podcaster as he is now, and his sponsor, his I think only notable sponsor at that point, was the Fleshlight. And being as square as I am and worried about the mismatch between his sponsorship needs at that point and my budding career as a public intellectual, I said, listen, Joe, I'm happy to do your podcast, but there's no way I'm coming on there 30 seconds after you just shill for the Fleshlight.
That's kind of funny. Was that, like, were you so, like, I don't know at what point you got into topics that I'm sure get you a lot of hate mail from all sorts of people. Was that before then? And yet you were more afraid of a sex toy than some of the, like, religion and other topics that you willingly delve into?
Yeah, no, I was well into all those controversial topics, but it just seemed like the mismatch between the Fleshlight and talking about jihadism or whatever I was going to talk about with him, it just seemed too insane. So,
anyway, all I wanted to say is that they told me that one of their best sellers at the time, back when I talked to them, was a blue one because of the movie Avatar.
Yeah, I guess I tapped into the Jungian archetype of just how weird things are going to get here. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I guess it shouldn't. This is of a piece with transhumanism on some level. I mean, just the idea that we are only Homo sapiens more or less by accident, and we're not going to be them for long. We are building a different future for ourselves, both by interacting with technology to the degree that we do, and, you know, ultimately, when genetic engineering becomes commonplace, we will be free to not merely tattoo ourselves, but actually refine our biology all the way down to the studs. And, you know, I guess that's not, on some level, playing with the boundary of humanness and what is, you know, what humans feel like interacting with, sexually and otherwise. There's no way to avoid that. That's just what we're going to do. We're doing it already.
Well, as someone who's outside this field, I think the challenge I'm really in touch with is how hard it is to take the safety concerns emotionally seriously, and how hard it is for people in the field to do that as well. I can't tell you how many people outside this room who purport to be experts think the control problem is a total non-issue. It's flabbergasting to meet these people, and therefore not worth thinking about. And one of the reasons I think is that in the one case there's this illusion that the time horizon matters. If you feel that this is 50 or 100 years away, that is totally consoling, but there's an implicit assumption there. The assumption is that you know how long it will take to build this safely, and that 50 or 100 years is enough time. The other issue is I think most people feel like intelligence is an intrinsic good, and of course we want more of it, and it's very easy to be in touch with that assumption because, I mean, right now there's a cure for cancer, which we have not discovered. Right? How galling is that? But for more intelligence, but for knowing which experiments to run or how to integrate the data we already have in hand, we would have a cure for cancer that was actionable now, unless there was some physical law of the universe that prevented us from curing cancer, which seems unlikely. So the pain of not having enough intelligence is really excruciating when you focus on it. But and I think to your previous question of doing this quickly becomes an intrinsic good, provided we have solved the alignment problems and the political problems and the chaos that would follow if we were just if we did it quickly without solving those problems. So I think it's the thing that is alarming is how ethereal these concerns are, even to those who have no rational argument against them.
So Sam, it sounds to me like you're agreeing very strongly with what Shane Legge said, that there is, in some circles, there's still the strong taboo that, you know, don't even consider the possibility that we might get AGI because it's just absolutely ridiculous. And he was arguing that if the sooner we can get rid of this taboo, the sooner people can get to work and find all these really helpful solutions and answers that we need. So suppose for a moment that I came up to you and I said to you, this idea of superhuman intelligence just sounds absolutely ridiculous. It sounds completely nuts. And by the way, I've never seen your TED talk. And we're in an elevator. You have only 30 seconds to persuade me to take this more seriously. What would you say? And a lot of people who are here will have this exact conversation with colleagues and others in the future.
Well, there are very few assumptions you need to make to take this seriously intellectually. Again, the emotional part is a separate piece. But if you assume that intelligence is just on some level the product of information processing in a physical system, and there are very few people who dispute that and who are scientifically literate at this point, and you assume that we will continue to improve our information processing systems unless something terrible happens to us to prevent that, and that seems like a very safe assumption, then it is just a matter of time before we instantiate something that is human level and beyond in our computers. And again, the time horizon is only consoling on the assumption that we know we have enough time to solve the alignment problems and the political problems. The other thing that's humbling here that Ray brought up at one point is that even if we were handed a perfectly benign, well-behaved AI just from God, you know, we're given a perfect oracle, we're given a perfect inventor of good technology, given our current political and economic atmosphere, that would produce total chaos. We just have not, we don't have the ethical or political will to share the wealth. We don't have the political integration to deal with this thing being given to Silicon Valley and not being given at the same moment to China or Iran. So there's just, it's alarming that the best case scenario currently, basically just ripping out 80% of Nick's book, because we've solved all those problems, is still a terrifying one. And so clearly that's a near-term thing that we have to solve.